We are holding on page Nuntes in Sanhedrin and nine lines from the top, middle of our Kofkes. We're in the middle of, we started learning yesterday, a bunch of different individuals or groups who questioned about Tchias and Nesim, and they asked different Chachamim, and each one in the Chachamim gave them answers. We had the Tzedukim asking Ram Gamliel, and Ram Gamliel giving them an answer. And we had in between we also had Rav Elazar ben Rav Yossi pointing out something about the Minim. So then we had the Romans asking Rav Yeshua. So now we're up to the third one. Charlotte Cleopatra Malchus as Rav Meir. Queen Cleopatra asked Reb Meir. Now, there's a famous Queen Cleopatra in history, but she died about 100 years before Churban Bais Sheni, whereas Reb Meir was several decades after Churban Bais Sheni. So on the face of it, it can't mean her, it has to mean some other Cleopatra. It was a fairly common Greek name, so it would mean there was some other queen named Cleopatra in Reb Meir's times. The other possibility is maybe, in fact, now, Shalshala Sakabala brings up a point. Maybe indeed there was an earlier Reb Meir. Maybe there was indeed a Reb Meir who was contemporary with Cleopatra of Egypt. She was known to be a very cultured lady. She was very interested in the sciences and the knowledges of her time. So she might have been the appropriate one to ask this kind of question about a detailed Tchias and Nesim. So the famous Queen Cleopatra was queen of Egypt. She was a Greek lady. She's descended from one of Alexander the Great's generals, who Alexander the Great had conquered Egypt early in the time of the Second Byzantine Empire. We're going to have about him soon with Agrippa ben Sisa. And then after he died, his generals fought over his empire and eventually divided up in four major parts, one of which was Egypt. So you had a succession of a whole dynasty that came from one of his generals, ruled in Egypt generation after generation for around another 250, 300 years. And this Cleopatra was the last of them. So again, the one that the Gemara is saying over here might mean her, but in that case, then the Reb Meir would have to be an earlier Reb Meir because she died about 100 years before Churban Bais Sheni, and the Reb Meir we know of was a Talmud of Reb Akiva, who was a Talmud of Reb Eliezer and Reb Yeshua, who were alive at the time of the Churban. Reb Meir was much later. So either that, or it was a different Cleopatra. There was actually, for example, among the wives of Herders was also a Jewish lady named Cleopatra, so maybe it was her. But in that case also, it would still have to be an earlier Reb Meir, because again, that's during the time of the Second Byzantine Empire. Okay, be that as it may, she asked Reb Meir, she says, Yadina d'chayish shichli. I understand, I know that the dead are going to come alive. So unlike the previous groups, the Tzedukim and the Roimim, and we said also the Kusim, who b'chlal denied Tchias HaMesim, this Cleopatra, whoever she is, says, I understand that the dead are going to come alive. And we know that, d'chtib, because the Pasuk says, v'yatzitzu me'ir ke'esev ha'aretz. They will sprout forth in the city like the grasses of the field, meaning, as we learned yesterday, you have the Gemara tells us in Ksubas, you have the Nesim that passed away in Chutz La'aretz are going to go through tunnels to Eretz Yisrael, and they're going to pop out of the ground. So Meir, in the city of Yerushalayim, so they're going to come there, and then they're going to pop out of the ground like the way that grass grows. So she says, fine, I understand that means there's going to be a Tchias HaMesim. But Ella, which her question is, Kshein Onlin, when they stand up by Tchias HaMesim, Onlin, Arumim or Bilov Hashem Onlin, are they going to be naked, or are they going to have clothing? Now, when Marsha points out, her question was, if we're comparing them to grass, the Yatzitzu Me'ir Ke'esev Ha'aretz, grass comes out of the ground without any covering, so then in that case, maybe the Mason will as well. Which, though, would be a gnai for that, then why would the Pasuk be comparing them to grass and implying they're going to get up that way? So he answers her kavachomer mechitza. You can make a kavachomer from the way a grain of wheat is planted, and you can see the answer is that no, they're going to have clothing. Madach, a grain of wheat is buried in the ground naked. You have the grain has previously been processed, and part of the processing is removing the various shells and straw and whatnot that grow together with the wheat kernel. So when you plant the wheat kernel by itself, it doesn't have those coverings. Yotze b'kama levushim, but later on when the wheat grows from that kernel, it comes out with many layers on top of it, because those grow from it. Tzadikim shenikbarim b'levushim, so then the tzadikim who are buried with their levushim, with their tachrichim, alachas kama v'kama, how much more so that they're going to come out with clothing. Which Marsha says in that case, what he's answering her is, you're bothered by the fact that it says keisavar. That's very well. Grass is also very well. Wheat is also a type of grass. It's also a type of herb of the ground. And you see that it comes out with many coverings. So don't tell me, he says to her, that every time a plant comes out of the ground, it's naked. You see that wheat is not like that. Tosfos, by the way, elsewhere mentions a point. The Gemara tells us, which has an implication in Halacha, that very often actually wheat grains are planted with their coverings on them. The Gemara elsewhere has an expression that which comes up in the Halachas of Tumas Oichlin, that wheat is often planted together with its coverings, together with its various shells and whatnot, and therefore those are considered part of the wheat as far as the Halachas of Tumas Oichlin, the concept of Yad and Shomer and all that. So then why is the Gemara saying over here it goes into the ground naked? And the answer is, Tosfos says, what it means is it's not necessarily. It may be one or the other. But either way, it comes out with all those layers on top of it. So therefore, Alachas Kama V'Kama, the tzaddikim who were buried with their tachrichim. There's quite a lot of explanations among the various mefoshim and sfarim, what exactly was the point of her question, aside from the simple aspect of it. There's a number of different explanations. Among others, the Mabit, who was a chaver of the Beis Yosef, he served on the Beis Din of Tzfas, and together with him, has a couple of explanations. One of them is, he says, the question is, are we going to be naked, as in not having a Yetzahara, or are we still going to be clothed in the Yetzahara? And that in turn gets into the question then, are we going to need physical clothing? Before the Chetei Tadas, Adam and Chava didn't need clothing because their body itself was not a source of shame. As opposed to after the Chetei Tadas, then we realize that the body can be used for tumadika purposes as well, and therefore we have to cover ourselves. So that's part of her question also, is how is it going to be Osid Lovely? Right after Tchisa Mason. There's also explanations that she's asking, Adam and Chava were actually clothed with Ananea covered. How are the Mason going to be? Are they going to be clothed with Ananea covered, or are they going to be without that? And there's a lot of different interesting explanations. One very interesting one is, we touched on a little bit yesterday, the question was brought up 2 days ago, a goyim going to participate in Tchias Mason. So the Gemara tells us later in the parak, there are definitely going to be goyim around La'asid Lavei, because they're going to be the ones who help us with while we're busy learning, becoming chachamim b'toro, chachamim goyim b'toro of mitzvah. Somebody has to keep the world running. Somebody has to grow the food. Somebody has to keep the machines running and so forth. And that's going to be them. So therefore, now you can look at it, in other words, that the Jewish people then are the guf, and the goyim are like the lavush to that. Your body needs a lavush in the same way we need them as, so to speak, a protective thing. So then her question is, are there in fact going to be goyim at the time who constitute that lavush, or is it just going to be Jews and there's going to be no goyim at all? So that's the thing. So maybe she was Jewish, maybe not. The Gemara doesn't say one way or the other. If she was the famous Cleopatra, who's known to history, then she was a Goethe. She was the Greek queen of Egypt. Why does she want to know? She's curious. Again, you know, if it was that historical Cleopatra, she is known to have been a very smart, cultured woman. She would have been curious about it. If you say, again, a possibility is maybe it was the Cleopatra who was one of the wives of Herodias, well, then she's a Jewish woman herself. So then she'd want to know. And if you say that it's a later Cleopatra in the times of the known Tanit of Meir, then okay, she may have been a Jew, she may have been a Bepashta, she would have been a Goethe. There weren't any Jewish queens at that time. But whatever, there's different possibilities, right?
Made out of woolen linen?
Tachrichim in principle, they can be made out of anything. It just has to be something fairly cheap so that you don't have people, the Gemara mentions in Moed Cotton, that the people used to make very expensive tachrichim, and it became a burden, and Torah Gamliel ordered that they should use linen, and that became the common minhag. Technically, yes, you could actually make them out of wool and linen, because as the Gemara tells us elsewhere, mitzvahs betalus lasid lavoi, and therefore it's not a problem if the mason are wearing shatnez. In practice, tachrichim are usually made out of linen. Okay. Onward. Amalei Keso de Rabban Gamliel. The Keso, the Roman emperor, says to Rabban Gamliel, Amritu de Shachri Chaye. You're saying that the dead come to life. Hohavu Afra. But they turn into dust. The Afra Miko Chaye. How can dust come alive again? Now, Marsha explains that this case of Bechlal, it's not just that he didn't believe in Tchias Mason. He didn't believe, to begin with, that Hashem had created Adam as Ofer Min HaAdama either. Otherwise, what kind of question is that? How could dust come alive? It did, by Bereis Olam. So he was one of those people who held, as you had, there was a popular Goyish notion at that time, and it's not even completely dead nowadays either, that the world has always existed. That there was never any Bria in the first place. So therefore, Rangamil can't answer him that you see Hashem created Adam from dust. So he needs a different answer. So his daughter said to him, now his daughter could mean Rav Gamliel's daughter, or it could mean the emperor's daughter. I think most of the Mephoshim seem to understand, Rashi specifically says it means the daughter of the Keso, and I think most of the Mephoshim follow suit. So she interjected. She says, Sharke, she says to Rav Gamliel, leave him alone. I'll give him an answer. I'll give my father an answer myself. Earlier in the Masechta, we have something similar with that as well, where the Keser challenged Rav Gamliel about a detail involving the creation of Chava. And again, there the daughter interjected and gave a very satisfactory answer. So she says, she says to her father, Shnei Yotzrim Yesh Be'irenu. In our city, there are two potters, two people who make pottery. Echad Yotzim and Amayim, Ve'echad Yotzim and Atit. One of them makes kelim out of water. The other one makes them out of clay. Ezim Ehen Meshuvach, which one is the more praiseworthy one? Which one is obviously the much greater expert? Obviously, the one who can turn water, who can turn liquid water into a solid keli, must be the much greater, must be a real wizard. So the daughter says to him, "In Amayim, sir, well then, if Hashem can create a human being from water, from the liquid, from the zera, minatit like kol shekein, then how much more so Hashem can create a person from the mud, from the dust that a person has crumbled into." So in other words, as Maharsha explains, she couldn't give an answer that involves Briyas HaOlam. She had to give an answer that involves, you see, Maisim B'chol Yom, that people are born, and where do they come from? Ma'ayin Basim Etip Asurucha. So therefore, so if Hashem can do that, how much more so from the dust? Now, however, Rashi brings a second explanation that she says that Hashem created the whole world from Tohu. Which we have in the pasuk so we see that there was water over there and Hashem created everything from that. But Maharsha says that wouldn't work in this case. If the Keser doesn't believe in Briyas HaOlam in the first place, then bringing him a proof that Hashem created the world when it was all watery is not going to help us. So we need rather the first explanation that it means that people are created from Shechva Zera. The Gemara continues. Dvei Rabbi Shmuel Tana. In the yeshiva of Rabbi Shmuel, they learned a different way of figuring this out. How we can show that Chesed Meisim is not only possible but logical. Ma kavuchomer mekli zchuchis. You can make a kavuchomer from glass kalim. So maybe she said this, or maybe Tana and Rabbi Shmuel was saying this on their own. Rashi explains that Zui Chuvashe Shiva Lavia. Rashi explains that Tana and Rabbi Shmuel is a different version of what she answered her father. The first version is that she told him, imagine a potter who makes kalim out of water. And in the second version, Rabbi Shmuel was saying, no, that's not the answer she gave him. Rather, she gave him an answer, consider Kleis Chuchis. Ma kleis chukas sham molan beruach. How are glass kalim made in the first place? You make them with wind. A person blows breath into the molten glass and shapes it. They're created. They're manufactured using human breath. Nishbru, and if they break, yeshlem takana, then it's still possible to fix them. You can melt down the fragments and you can make new glass out of it. So then a boss of the dom that was created using the spirit, using the breath of Hashem, Allah has come of a kama, how much more so that he can be recreated even when he fell apart into dust. What forces Rashi to say that this is Rabbi Shmuel's version, Tanur Rabbi Shmuel's version of what the princess said, rather than understand the pastors that it's just Tanur Rabbi Shmuel bringing their own independent kavachomer? Maharsha says because you don't need that. What kind of chesed mason do you need? We have all the psukim. Tanur Rabbi Shmuel can resort to one of those psukim. But when you're talking to a goyish king, to a goyish emperor, and he doesn't believe in those psukim, then you need a kavachomer for that. Now Rashi points out an interesting thing. The Gemara in Chagiga, the Gemara in Chagiga tells us the whole tragic story of Acher, Elisha ben Avoya, who went off the derech for various reasons that it says over there, and became an apikoros and so forth, and you have all the whole long tragic story of that over there. And it says that Reb Meir continued to learn Torah from him. And so it says that one time Acher asked Reb Meir, what do you say? What's your explanation of a certain pasuk in Ir that compares the Torah to gold and glass? Why dafka those things? And Reb Meir answers, because just like gold and glass, it's very easy to lose them the same way it's very easy to lose Torah if you don't review it again and again. And Acha says, I'll tell you actually something that Reb Akiva said differently. He said, gold and glass, Kalim, if they break, Reb Meir says, Noichim La'abdon, they're very easy to break. So then the implication seems to be that once a glass keli is broken, then that's it. Whereas here, whereas over here, the princess is saying that you could fix them. Rashi says, no, of course you can fix them. All it means is at the moment they're broken, and that's it. The keli is gone unless you go and melt it down and fix it. In the same way, the mayor is saying over there, it's very easy for a person to lose his turda if he doesn't review it. So, again, that's another way that she says to her father is another way of understanding how Tchias HaMesim is possible. B'chlal, the Maharal explains on this Gemara over here. He says a lot of these questions are predicated on the idea the whoever it is that's asking, the Kaser or the Tzedukim or all the other groups over there, they can't believe such a thing is possible because we never see it happen. Where do you ever see it? Tchias HaMesim happens. So each of the Chachamim is telling them, you're right, we never see it happen because it's L'mayla Miderech HaTeva. But you can draw an analogy to it from something that you see nowadays, the same way as nowadays. You can see it is possible, for example, to melt down a glass keli and remake it. Or it is possible, for example, for the Tiferes Yisrael brings a mushal on it. He says, imagine you had somebody who never saw somebody plant a seed and grow a plant from it, or a tree. If you tell him that this big, gigantic tree comes from one little seed, he would say, you don't know what you're talking about. You know, he couldn't imagine such a thing, but nevertheless, them is the fact. So the same way when it comes to Tchias HaMesim. So each of the Chachamim is telling them that you don't see it nowadays, yeah, because it's not part of the Teva that we're familiar with nowadays. But the concept exists, and all it is we're just not familiar with it. The next one, the fifth one in the group, Amaleahu Mina Utsduki Lirab Ami. A certain Min Utsduki says to Rab Ami. So in the simon that we had yesterday, in the Gemara, we had the simon Serek Gam Geshem Kam Simon, or Serek Kam Geshem Gam Simon, whatever. The fifth letter in both the questioners and the answers was a Men. So therefore, it seems it has to be Mina, it has to be a Min, and Tzduki is one of those things where the sense is changed, so that way it's a Min, and the question is to Rab Ami. Okay, anyway, so the Min, or the Tzduki, whatever it is, says to Rab Ami, Amritu Deshach V'chaye, see, same question. You're telling me that the dead comes alive, come alive again, Hohavu Afra, but they become dust, V'afra Mikochaye, and how can dust come alive again? So Rav Ami answers, Emshal Chomashal, Amar Dev Adonai. Here, I'll give you a mashal so you can understand it better. He tells his servants, "Luchu uvnuli paltirin gdolim, go and build me a great big palace, b'makom shein mayim va'ofer, in a place where there's no water and there's no dust to work with. So you have to bring in, all the raw materials from elsewhere." Well, they went and did it. They went and schlepped in all the materials and built it. Eventually, the palace collapsed. He tells them, Chizru v'nu oysan, b'makom sheyash ofer mayim. Go and rebuild it in a place where there's dust and water. They said, we can't. Cross the land. He gets angry at them. B'makom shein mayim v'ofer b'nisem. You were able to build in a place where there's no water and no dust, where all the raw materials have to come from elsewhere. B'nisem, and you were able to build. Achshav sheyesh mayim v'ofer. How now that there's water and dust? Alachas kama v'kama. How much more so? In other words, Reb Ami is saying, look, you're bothered by the fact that the mason become dust. Sure, but Hashem started out with a tip of katana, with a tiny little drop of zera, which has no mamashus in it almost, and yet the Eibush to create an entire body from it, which is in effect like bringing all the water and dust and all the materials from someplace else. How much more so that Hashem can we create a person from dust? And again, Rashi's second explanation is the whole world Hashem created out of Tohu. So if Hashem could create Yesh Me'ayin, then certainly, but Tchias HaMesim, Hashem can certainly create Yesh Me'yesh. The dust is there, after all, you know, to put it in modern terms, you know, all the chemicals that the person is made up of are there. All they have to do is they have to be reassembled into the right molecules. Okay, so there's no reason that Eibush shouldn't be able to do that. Alachas kama v'kama, you can create the molecules where they didn't exist in the first place. Continues Reb Ami to this fellow, V'in Einat Amamin. He says, if you don't believe this, that even now you can see an example where the Eibush to create something from dust. Sela Bika, go out to a valley, or to a Achbar, and you'll see a type of mouse. And actually, interestingly, actually translates it by a French word which means a squirrel. So maybe the word achbar in Gemara terminology means more generally various kinds of small rodents, which, yeah, can include mice and rats and squirrels and various other creatures like that. Anyway, shayim chetzie boser b'chetzie adama. Today, you'll look at it and you'll find half of it is flesh and half of it is dirt. L'macher hishritz, the next day, it completely gets formed and starts moving. V'nasa kolid boser, and the whole thing becomes flesh. So what creature are we talking about? So there are, it's also mentioned, it comes up in Halacha as well. It comes up in Gemara and Chulin, which is going to be in a couple of weeks in Daf HaYomi. It comes up where the Gemara discusses the Halacha over there. We know that the Shemona Shrotzim, when they're dead, are Matame. What about, for example, you have this part of this mouse that's still dirt, that is not yet flesh. Would it be Matame a person when he touches it? Anyway. The question is what it is exactly. So there are various ancient scientists and writers who write about such a creature, and then they say they've been described it, and they give the details about it. The Rambam writes actually in Pirush HaMishnayos there in Chulin. The Rambam says many people tell about it, but he says it's a little hard to understand how such a thing could be. But b'chlal, back then it was an accepted scientific idea that living creatures can come from non-living material. And this comes up in halacha here and there as well. You have halacha, for example, that you're allowed to kill lice on Shabbos because consider they're not part of a rova. They don't come from a male and female. They generate spontaneously from sweat or dirt or whatever. There's a couple of other areas in halacha where this kind of thing comes up. So over time, eventually, in the last few hundred years, scientists came to the conclusion that there's no such thing. You never have living creatures that come from non-living material. So then so what's the deal? And in fact, for example, the Pachad Yitzchak, who was an early Achron, who lived in Italy, is to say for Pachad Yitzchak, is a very comprehensive encyclopedia of halacha. He says maybe nowadays that scientists have discovered that lice are in fact part of rubber. Maybe it should be also to kill them on Shabbos. So he says, his Rebbe didn't really agree with that kind of chiddush, but there is such a concept. On the other hand, you have various achronim that talk about that. No, the halacha is a halacha regardless, even if the reason that the Gemara gives behind it is no longer necessarily valid scientifically, nevertheless, the halacha remains a halacha, and we'd have to say there's a different reason behind it. With that said, the Rebbe talks about in a letter that maybe not even necessarily, just because scientists have done experiments, and they've claimed, and they've found that it seems that every time you have a living creature comes from a previous living creature, not necessarily. Does that mean it can never be the other way around? It just means the fact that they haven't found evidence of it, absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. The fact that they didn't find something doesn't mean it's impossible.
Interesting that evolution is saying that's exactly what.
Yeah, the evolutionists claim that it actually came from non-living matter. Yeah, that's a whole other matter too. Yeah, yeah. In any case, so what is the deal with this creature? There are later Mephoshim that talk about there's a creature that lives in Egypt and in some other places, and in English it's called a jerboa. It's a little mouse-like creature with a very long tail. And yeah, the creature gives birth in tunnels and burrows underground. And when the babies start coming out of the ground, there comes a part where it looks like they're half alive and half still earth, because like their back, their hindquarters are still covered with mud and dirt or whatever. So maybe that's what it is. So at least to all appearances, it looks like it comes from the dirt, but in fact, it would really be that it actually comes from parents. Rav Shamshon Ofol Hirsch actually has an interesting take on this also. He says, you know, listen, given that we have ancient Goyish writers that write about such a creature as factual. So he says, imagine even nowadays, for example, somebody were to tell you that a certain creature exists. Let's say you don't have the ability to look it up yourself. You don't have Wikipedia available to go look it up or something. So you'll have to take him at his word. Well then, if you're a Talmud Chacham, you're going to start clearing the din of it. Well, what's the din? What would be the din of it? Well, the same way, he says, if the Chachamim are being informed by what they consider to be reliable sources that such a creature exists, then they have to deal with the halachas of it, whether in fact it existed, whether it exists or not, is not their business. Just rather, if such a creature existed, what would be the din of it? Anyway. So again, sort of Ami tells the seller that you have here an example of foretaste of Chiyas HaMeisim. Shema Toimel is Man Merubah. So you're going to say, okay, well, that takes a while. It's not necessarily an immediate thing that it turns from dirt into flesh, even though he used the expression L'mocho Hishritz, that takes a little while for the creature to be born. So Rabbani says, fine, I'll give you another example. Alei Lahar, go up to a mountain, or Eisha Yoyim Envay Ela Chilozin Achas, and you'll see that today, when there hasn't been rain, there's not even one Chilozin. The next day, rain falls, and all of a sudden the whole place is full of chelzoinus. So Rashi explains the chilozin over here is the famous chilozin from which Tchelas is made. So the idea would be, the Gemara tells us in Menachos, it comes out of the sea only once every 70 years. So the point is, in other words, like this, like they burrow underground or something, or on the beach, and then when there's a rainfall, then they all of a sudden come out. So like it also appears like there's been a Tchias Mason out of nowhere. So other
mafotes. You're saying basically every time they come out, things similar to Tchias HaMeisim.
Similar to Tchias HaMeisim. But Frat, again, keep in mind that, you know, back then it wasn't necessarily known so much that these creatures actually come from eggs or from, as far as the lice also, for example, there was an explanation that lice do come from eggs, but they're microscopic, and in general, Halacha doesn't pay attention to microscopic things that the naked eye can't see. So that could be an answer. So the same thing over here with these chelzonas, it might be they come from some kind of microscopic egg or something, and therefore, even though biologically there's life that comes from life, but nevertheless, as far as the Gemara is concerned, you can consider that it's Yesh Ma'ayin in a sense. With that said, there are other Mephoroshim who explain that the Chilozin is some other type of creature, not necessarily the Chilozin of Tchelas. Ian Yaakov points out a fascinating thing over here. He says, two of the proofs that we just brought for Tchias HaMeisim were not proofs, the law are not proofs so much, but logical things to show that it's possible, are one from glassware and the other one from the Chilozin. Now, the Gemara tells us in Megillah that Zvulun's territory contained both of those things. What happened was, the Gemara explained that Zvulun complained, Zvulun l'choif yamim yishkan, their territory is mostly by the sea coast, and he complains, I don't have food or land like the rest of the Shvatim do in Eretz Yisrael. So Hashem tells him, yes, but you're going to have two great resources that are found only in your territory and nowhere else. The type of good quality sand from which you can make glass, especially clear glass, which was a very expensive item in olden days, and also the chilozin for making tchelas. So now, says Ion Yaakov, here we're talking about tchias HaMeisim. Now, for a person to be zoichet to tchias HaMeisim, as we said before, a person has to have an involvement with Torah, which is why we said that a person, for example, says that the ein Torah min haShemayim loses his opportunity for tchias HaMeisim. Now, the question is, though, and now the Gemara in Ksubas explains, what about Amei Oretz, who are not so involved with Torah? Well, if they support Tamar HaChamim, then they still, Va'atam Advekim, Vashem Alekechem, Chaim Kul Chamayoyim, and therefore there's Zoycha Teir as well. Very appropriate, therefore Yisachar learned Torah, and Zvulun supported them. That was the original Yisachar Zvulun partnership. Very appropriately, then the two special things that you find in Zvulun's territory are two of the things that we can use as a logical example of Tchias HaMeisim. Then the Gemara says, "Amaleahu mino tzduki legvia ben psisa." A certain min tzduki, again, probably the original girsa was min, and it was changed, says to gvia ben psisa. As we're going to see, gvia ben psisa lived in the time of Alexander the Great, so early in the time of the second Nisim English. So we find in this Gemara, and we find in various other places, he was a very kluge yid. He was very smart. He was a very smart guy. So one time, this min, so really whether it means min or tzduki, it's a little hard. The tzduki only came into existence about 100 years after that time. As far as minim often means things like the early Christians, and that's even a few hundred years later. So it might mean, min can more generally, you know, if the Rambam defines a min as somebody who has any of various wrong heretical beliefs about Hashem. So it could be there were groups like that in earlier times as well, even before the Christians came along. Anyway, so this means, what? Yeah, the Issyim, Well, even the Issyim themselves didn't necessarily exist at that time yet, but okay, in any case, he says, woe to you, you wicked ones, chayavaya, like the word chayav, some people who are going to be found chayav, who are going to be found guilty in judgment. Damnitu mese chayin, you say the dead are going to come alive. So he says, how is that supposed to work? The chayin mesi, even the ones who are alive now eventually die. The mesi chayin, you're telling me the ones who are dead are going to come alive? Scientifically, there's a concept in science called entropy, which is basically randomness. like you have, there's the idea, you know, you have the, you'll have in the world those things that have a certain seder to them, and then you have, eventually the seder falls apart, food rots, and so on, and many other examples like that, and you know, things lose their seder. Things don't spontaneously gain seder, they lose it. You have, let's say, for example, a neat house has less entropy in it than when you have, when things are scattered all over the place, then it means there's a lot more entropy. Well, you're not going to have a messy house is not going to spontaneously become clean. So therefore, so this min or tzuki is in effect arguing the same thing. A body dying is more entropy. And you're telling me it's going to go backwards and you're going to have less entropy, less randomness. How is such a thing supposed to work? Amalei. So Gria answers him, on the contrary, woe to you, wicked ones, Damriti Mesi Loichayin, you're claiming the dead won't come alive. You can argue the other way around. Deloi Havu Havu or Chaye, even people who did not exist yet come into existence. So you see there's an example of Bilti Seder becoming Seder, becoming a fully formed human being. The Havu, like Kol Shekin, how much more so somebody who was before, that he can come alive again, that the Seder can be remade and the entropy can be undone. Now, why is he called, why are each other calling them, why are they calling each other Chayavaya? Why is the Min calling the Jews Chayavaya and vice versa? Marshall explains like this. Further on, much later in the Perek, we're going to talk about, there are certain, besides in our Mishnah, we said there are certain people who lose the opportunity for Tchias HaMesim. We're going to say there were certain generations of people, the Dora Mabul, the people of Sedoim, etc., who are not going to come alive by Tchias HaMesim. Then on the other hand, you have others who are going to come alive by Tchias HaMesim to be punished once and for all for the bad things they did, for the Averis they did. So now this Min says to the Jewish people, you're telling me you're going to come alive, okay, but what good is it? Chayavaya, all you're going to be doing, you're going to come alive to be punished for your Averis. So wouldn't you be better off if you claim that the Mason will not come alive, then at least you're free from that? And Gvia answers him right back, no, on the contrary, you're the Chayavaya. You're from the type of Yeshoyim who are not even going to come alive by Tchias HaMesim at all. Maybe the ones who come alive, they're going to be punished, but eventually they can still have a place in Olam Habah. But you're going to be even worse off. You're not even going to be zeicher to Tchias HaMesim in the first and to Chaye Olam Haba in the first place. So there's that. A related explanation from another one of the Mefarshim is he's saying that a person is created and there's so much opportunity for a person to do Averis and to mess up. So he's saying that so even people are going to come alive by Tchias HaMesim. So what? They're going to do Averis again and then they're going to do Averis again. So what do you want Tchias HaMesim when it just gives more people more opportunity to do Rishus? And the Min doesn't realize this. Ruach HaTov Ma'aminaretz. So Gria tells him, on the contrary, to say that there's not going to be a Tchias HaMesim is wickedness. Okay, people are going to come alive. That's Tchias HaMesim. They're going to be free of the Yetzer Hara. They're not going to be doing Averis then. Omalei, so the Min got very offended. Omalei Chayavaya Karisli, you're calling me wicked. He can dish it out, but he can't take it. He has no problem calling Gria and the rest of the Jews Chayavaya, but he can't take it himself. So you're calling me Chayavaya, Ika Imna, if I do in fact get up by Tchias HaMesim, but Itna Bach, then I'll give you a kick then, or Pashitna Lach Musach Minach, and I will straighten out your humpback. Gvir ben Psisa was a hunchback. He had a deformity in his spine that was bent over. So now this fellow tells Gvir that when we come alive by Tchias HaMesim, I'll use my opportunity and I'll give you a kick and then straighten out your back. Amalei, so Gvia answers him, Imata Oisakane, you know what, if you do that, Roifer Uman Tikore, you'll be called an expert doctor of a Sakhar Habitito, and you'll be able to command a high fee. Yeah, nobody's been able to ever cure my hunchback. If you can do it, then Adadaba. What does he mean by that? Besides the fact that it just seems like a Gleich Vertel between them, the guy's upset, and then Gvia sort of answers him with a joke. Ion Yaakov points out another point as well. He says, you're telling me a Kavachoyma, anybody you see that people come alive who weren't before, so what? He says, when we come alive, that's Tchias HaMesim, you could argue like that also. Normally, if a person has a straight back and they give him a kick, he's gonna get a hunchback. So you could argue the other way around as well. You could say that, so how much more so somebody who had a hunchback is never going to be cured. But nevertheless, I'll show you that I can do it. And Gria says, no, you're actually not going to be able to do it. Anybody who would be able to do that is a very expert doctor and no such exists. So therefore, my Kavachoymer is valid after all. That you see that even those who didn't exist yet still continue to still come into existence. You can't slug that up by saying that you could have somebody who had a hunchback and gets cured from it because you see such things don't happen. So yes, the Gvir ben Psisa was hunchbacked. In fact, in the next story over here in the Gemara, he calls himself a hedyot. He calls himself a simple person, and an explanation of that is, by rights, with his chochma, he should have been a member of the Sanhedrin. But earlier in the Masechta, the Gemara tells us a person who is a balmum cannot be a member of the Sanhedrin. Therefore, he was not able to, therefore he's only a hedyot. So, since we're mentioning Gvir ben Psisa, then the Gemara tells us a story involving him. Actually, there's going to be three different stories, but we'll do one of them today, and we'll continue tomorrow, we'll continue next time, Be'ez Hashem. So, Tana Rabbanan, B'chof Dalad Ben, this is a Braisa from Gilas Tainis. The Gilas Tainis is a Sefer that was written, a small Sefer that was written towards the end of the Second Nisim Mikdash, that lists different days, mostly in the time of the Second Nisim Mikdash, when Nisim and great things happened to the Jewish people. All of them, the Chum said, you're not allowed to fast on. Some of them, they said, you're also not allowed to make a spade on. So it's called Megillas Tainis, because days when you're not allowed to fast. It's Machlokas in the Gemara, in the Sefer Tainis, whether Butler Megillas Tainis or not, or the Yom Tovim, and they're no longer in effect after the Churban, and the Halacha is they're not, except for Hanukkah and Purim. Although there are poskim who say that maybe at least the Tzibur shouldn't make a Tainis Tzibur on those days. Anyway, so it goes through month by month, and it lists the days. So B'chof Dalad Ben Nisan, on the 24th of Nisan, or actually in Megillas Tainis, it actually has it as the 25th of Sivan, is Netilu Dimusnoi Miyehuda Om Yerushalayim. The Dimusnoi were taken out of Yehuda and Yerushalayim. Rashi explains Dimusnoi means Urdin and Bale Chamas, people who are protesting, who are forcing people to give them over their fields or whatever, extortionists and claiming that they're theirs. The Aruch gives a different explanation that Dimusnoi means rulers. Whatever the case, you had a group of Goyim who claimed ownership over Eretz Yisrael. Namely, Kshabo Bnei Afrika Lodunim Yisrael Lefnei Alexandros Moten. The people of Africa, of North Africa, came to argue with the Jewish people in front of Alexandros Moten, Alexander the Great, claiming that they should have ownership of Eretz Yisrael. Now, Chazal tell us that Marsha brings it over here, that when before the Jewish people came across the Yarden to come into Eretz Yisrael, Yeshua sent three letters to the Goyim, offering them three choices. You can stay and accept Shevet Mitzvah Neneach and subservience to the Jewish people, and then you can stay, or you can leave and find yourself a different place to live, or you can stay and do neither, and we're going to fight you. So the Givonim ended up accepting the first option, and they became Chotveitz and B'Shevimayim. The Gilgoshi have Gilgoshi Omadufana. They left, and then Hashem helped them. They found a very fertile place in North Africa, and they settled over there, which was later on in the parak, we're going to learn that it was a place equal in quality to Eretz Yisrael. It's interesting, by the way, there's a Goyish historian from about 1,500 years ago who at one point visited there. He says he saw two monuments over there that they had set up, where it said on them, it says on them in an ancient script, we are the people who came from the land of Canaan because of the robber Yoshua ben Nun who forced us out. Anyway. So now these Girgoshim are coming back to claim Eretz Yisrael. And they're coming to Alexander the Great, who had just conquered Eretz Yisrael and much of the known world. Amruloi, they argued, Eretz Canaan Shalano, he Eretz Canaan belongs to us. Just in Eretz Canaan, the Gulei Sar. We see the Pasuk continues to call it Eretz Canaan. O Canaan Avun Dahanu in Shehava. And Canaan is our ancestor. So we should be entitled to Eretz Yisrael. Now, the obvious question is, what kind of a question is that? Don't they know if they're already doing from Pesukim? They already know that there's many Pesukim where Hashem says, I'm throwing the Goyim out of Eretz Yisrael and I'm bringing you in instead. Maharsha explains, their argument was, very well, as long as Yisrael Osin Ritzon Shamokim and the Jewish people are independent, sure, we have no claim to Eretz Yisrael. But now, as it is, the Jewish people have sinned and they've been ruled over by Bovel and by Paras and Mordei and now by the Greeks. So what right do they have to Eretz Yisrael either anymore than we should be able to reassert our original claim? So Amalehu Gvir ben Psisa l'chachamim. So Gvir ben Psisa says to the chachamim, "Tnu li rishus, give me permission." Ve'elach ba'aduni mohem lifnei Alexander smoten. If you give me permission, I'll go and argue the matter in front of Alexander the Great against them. Im yinatzchuni, if they beat me, if they bring up a point that I don't have an answer to, imru, then you can say, so what? Had yit shabana nitzachtem. So you beat a commoner among us. That's not a fair fight. We demand a rematch with one of the members of the Sanhedrin or something. The imanianach seyachosim, and if I beat them, imdulahem, then you can tell them, it wasn't my doing, Torah's Moshe nitzachtechem, the Torah of Moshe beat you. Maharsha explains, in other words, especially, it's the best kind of counter-argument is when you can take the very thing itself that somebody was going to use as a proof, and use it and turn it around and use it as a proof against him. So therefore, Segria says, I'm going to bring them a proof from the Torah itself, and therefore you can say the very Torah that you thought you're going to bring your proof from is going to now be turned against you. So they gave him permission, hold off the dunning mind, and he goes and engages in the argument with them in front of Alexander the Great. So he says, where are you bringing your proof from? So they said, from the Torah, because again, Eretz Canaan. Well, very well. I'll also bring you a proof from the Torah, only from the Torah. Shenemar, Noach says, "Vayomer oru Knan, kursus Knan, eved avodim yelachav." He's going to be a slave of slaves to his brother. So Knan are slaves. Eved shekonin nechosim. Now, if an eved buys nechosim, buys any kind of property, eved lemir nechosim lemi. Who does the eved belong to? His master. Who does the nechosim belong to? Also his master, because the eved doesn't have any ability to acquire nechosim on his own. So therefore, so you are avodim, and you have no right to Eretz Yisrael. Now, Maharsha says, wait a minute, then, by that logic, then, couldn't we say that the Jewish people are also avodim to Yefes? Alexander is from the Greeks, or from Yefes, and therefore Yefes should also have the rights to part of Eretz Yisrael. So Maharsha explains, no, because the word eved avodim means even when the Jewish people, who are from Shem, are avodim to people from Yefes, nevertheless, Knan will be their eved. That Knan will be a slave to them, to Shem. Now she says on the pasuk, even when the Jewish people are in Golos, they'll still buy avodim from Knan. So therefore, so no, it's not like Yefes has any right to it. It means that Yefes rules over Shem, but in turn Shem rules over Knan and has the right to, then has the exclusive right to the land. The loy oid, not only that, he tells them, Elashare kamashonim shalai abatunu. Look at this, so many years you haven't been working for us. You owe us back work. Omer who Alexandrus Malka, so Alexander says to them, well, give him an answer. Omer loy, so they said, Tnomonozman Shloisha Yamin, give us 3 days to think up an answer. Nosman, he gave them time. Bodku, they checked into it, Vloimotsu Chuba, and they couldn't find a logical counter argument. Miyad Bochu, so right away they ran away. Vinichus, so they say, and Chain Zruis, they left their fields already planted, Vacharmei and Chain Natuis, and they left their vineyards already planted. Va'oisa Shona Shvias Hoisa, and that year was a Shmita year when there's no crops in Eretz Yisrael. So like this, these Goyim had taken over places in Eretz Yisrael, and now the Jewish people could take those lands, and now they have a crop for that year which the Goyim had very helpfully planted for them. Or it can even mean, some of Foreshim explain, that, Ion Yaakov says it can even mean that they abandoned their fields in Africa as well, and now the Jewish people can send boats over there and import food from them for Eretz Yisrael for the Shemitah year. There's an interesting chap in this that's brought based on something from the Chassam Sofer that says, okay, but that explains how the Jewish people are descended from Shem. So are lots of other nations. Maybe they should have a right to Eretz Yisrael because they're also the masters of Canaan. So there's an interesting chap that's brought about that by the Dura Flogger. Everybody wanted to be equals, so they all gave up their right, they all gave up their claim to have Avodim from Canaan. They're saying that all of us are going to be living in equality. Well, who wasn't involved in the Dura Flogger? Avram Avinu. Therefore, Avraham still keeps the right to have Avodim Knanim, even though the rest of the nations forewent that privilege. There was an interesting thing, actually. There's a posik in the Novi Micha and Trey Osir that says, Oid HaYodesh Oviloch. It says that the Jewish people, because of their Averis, Hashem says, I'm going to bring the Yodesh to you, the inheritor. So it actually has an interesting point brings there from some Medrash, that the idea is, Shem's eldest son was Elam, which is from them came some of the Persians later on. The Jewish people are descended from Arpachshad, which is Shem's third son. So Hashem is saying over there, really, by rights, Elam, the eldest, should have had Eretz Yisrael, which is the best of lands. Instead, Hashem gave them a different part of the world, the country of Elam, the area around Shushan, and you Jewish people got Eretz Yisrael. But if you're not gonna behave the way you're supposed to in Eretz Yisrael, then Hashem says, I will bring the Yerush, Elam will come and take over because they're after all the Bechor. So there is that idea to a certain extent that other B'nai Shem have a certain limited right to Eretz Yisrael as well, but primarily it's for us Jews. Yeah. As Rashi says, the very first Rashi in Chumash, the Goyim claim, Listematim, then we say Hashem created the world and he decides who gets it. Okay. Yom Yom Mashiach HaGoloch HaGimel Menachem Av. In this world, in this Gashmiyistika world, we can't perceive what Or Eliki is. We can understand how it works, we can understand that there's a Metzias of it, but we can't understand its Mahus. Gan Eden is going to be a higher level. We'll understand the mahus of the light of Mamalek Olam, and we'll understand what that light is. Yemosim Mashiach is going to be still higher. The Gashmias itself is going to be refined, and the person will have shining in Hetzel Melekin, light before the Chekei Tzedas, even more so then there'll be Giluim from Sozer Olam. And then the highest is going to be Asher Kriyas Mesim, then you have the ultimate perfection of Olam Hazeh, and then you'll have the Gilui, not just of Mamala, not just of Sozer, but of Atzmus Oren Sozer, Baruch Hu. Okay. One second, halacha real quick. If a person took off his tefillin and he didn't plan to put him on until like 2 or 3 hours later and then he changes his mind and decides to put it on sooner, then he has to make another bracha for it because it's considered a hefek hadas. But if he planned, when he took off the tefillin, he planned to put him on shortly afterwards and then in fact he puts them on shortly afterwards within those 2 or 3 hours, he doesn't have to make another bracha on them because they were already patur with the first bracha, provided that, as we'll learn next time an exception to that rule. So here we're talking about when he takes them off, where he's not required to take him off halacha, he's just taking him off for a side reason, as opposed to, well, so it's not Masiyah Das, as opposed to, well, next time if he has to go to the bathroom in between, that has different dinim. Yeah.